You are Locked On Nets, your daily Brooklyn Nets podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Welcome in to a strep throat edition of the Locked On Nets podcast. I'm your host, Gavin Shaw. After 4 years covering the Phoenix Suns, I am back in my native New York City to cover the Brooklyn Nets, along with the lifelong fan, Josh Bass, fresh off a trip to Costa Rica and a trip to the Barclays Center to watch Nets Raptors last night. And Josh, we'll touch a little bit on 76ers Nets later, but I want to start off with this. What was it like witnessing D'Angelo Russell's first quarter eruption? 24 points in the first 7 minutes of this one, 7 of 7 from 3-point range. I don't know if I've ever seen anything like that on TV, and I've certainly never seen that in person.
Yeah, it was crazy. I mean, I felt like I was back in Costa Rica because of how hot he was. I mean, he was just taking difficult threes off the dribble and just draining all of them. And I was looking at my friend right next to me every time and just
Marcus,
couldn't believe this was still happening.
Friend of the show. Yeah, no, it was incredible. And like I thought like the first three were like pretty amazing. Then he made four. And at that point, it was kind of surreal. Then he got fouled on one. And I was writing down, like taking notes, is like, all right, three in the first 3 minutes, four in the first 4 minutes, five in the first 5 minutes. And every other possession, he would just come down and hit one. And there was that one where like Ibaka was right on him. And I don't know if they showed this in the arena, but there was a replay on TV that showed like Ibaka like got him on the elbow. Like it didn't even affect him. Like he just drained it.
Yeah. I mean, once he gets in the zone like that, just he was unstoppable in that first quarter. Like nothing they could do could disrupt his rhythm at all. And it was great to see, and it was kind of magical being there in person for it. And I think the whole arena was just kind of in a state of euphoria.
Yeah. Everyone had needed a change of pants right after the first quarter. What it did like for you, does that like, I mean, obviously just like one game, in this case, it was literally 7 minutes because we were talking before the podcast started about D'Lo like not playing particularly well after this. I mean, we said he started 7 for 7 from that point going forward. He was only 3 of 15 from the field, didn't make another three the rest of the night. But did this like change your opinion about him as a shooter at all, and like what his ceiling is, just the fact that he could even get that hot, or you just thought it was like a total like abnormality, like once in a career type of deal?
No, yeah, it's not going to change the long-term outlook. I mean, you can't let 7 minutes color your entire perception of a player that plays 82 games in a season. I mean, it's great to see, of course, and obviously you want him to stay that hot, but at the end of the day, we've seen him have stretches like that. I mean, the game against New Orleans, he just caught fire in the second half. There was, I think, a game against Chicago, maybe, that he hit like three threes in the final few minutes of the fourth quarter and then just completely collapsed in overtime. I mean, he's a streaky player. He's someone that could just be absolutely devastating for 3 to 4 minutes, and then the rest of the game he disappears. So it's still not going to change my long-term outlook on him because he needs to gain consistency.
What do you think that comes down to? Like, is it just like better conditioning to a degree? Because like, I don't know, he didn't like even like necessarily seem tired, but it's almost like, to me, maybe it's like one of those things where like, as we've offset on this podcast, like he's for someone who projects, or some people consider like a future star in the league, like he's not that great of an athlete. So, and because of that, like a lot of shots he's attempting are on really tight margins. And if you can't consistently get easy looks for yourself, it's tough to consistently be an efficient scorer. Like, or what do you kind of pin that lack of consistency on?
Yeah. I mean, it comes down to a bunch of different things. One is conditioning. Two is that he just doesn't really have a lot of other playmakers around him to set him up for easy looks. So every time he has to create, he has to has a difficult shot ahead of him. And he's also doesn't take the best shots in general. His shot selection definitely needs to be worked on. So a combination of those factors, it's hard to stay hot when you're just taking tough look after tough look. And also his handle isn't great. So it's really hard for him to create separation on a consistent basis.
All right. And then obviously the other big thing from this game is that the Nets lost, had, I think an 11-point lead in the first quarter.
Did they?
And then, yeah, there was
I stopped paying attention after the first 7 minutes. I was just innocent.
you were passed out. You were on a sugar rush because you also got free food the whole game. And what did you tell me pregame? A black and white cookie and red velvet cake? You dabbled with both?
Yeah, I split that with Marcus. I was trying to God's plan the entire section, but I thought it would just be hard to coordinate that.
Yeah, no, that would have been great.
But yeah, Nets had an 11-point lead in the first quarter. Ended up scoring 40 points in the first quarter. Only had 35 the entire second half, which is insane compared to D'Lo scoring 24 in the first 7 minutes. But again, both were kind of freakish anomalies. The Raptors completely changed the game with how they started playing defense. And it kind of felt like for a while the Nets were going to stay in it, even though they led the whole first three quarters and then kind of blew the lead like halfway through. They were sticking with it like the game. I think it was like a 2-point game with 4 or 5 minutes left. And then the Raptors end on like a 14-2 run or 14-3 run. And at that point it was pretty much over. Jonas Valanciunas, totally unstoppable, 26-14. I think we both agreed that the most valuable guy for the Raptors was Freddie Van Vliet, a plus 31 in this game. No other Raptor was better than plus 7. So to me, that's so, like, I mean, it's indicative of how good the guy is, and he, like, is finally starting to get some recognition for how good he is. But that's just, like, insane for one guy to have that disproportionate of an effect on the team. And I think the eye test kind of backed it up with how well he was shooting the basketball, and on both ends of the floor, what he was doing, both running the offense and on the other end, he totally shut D'Lo down after he came in.
Yeah, no, he was complete pest on defense. I thought his defense changed the game because he was getting right up under D'Lo and Dinwiddie, pressuring them the whole length of the court, and they really couldn't get a lot of separation. And I think it also comes down to Jared Allen not being healthy. So the Nets really didn't have a ton of vertical spacing there, because obviously when Quincy AC or Dante Cunningham set a screen, they're just going to be popping out to the three-point line. So it's hard for guys like Dinwiddie and D'Lo to really beat their man, and if they have no role help, then the Nets offense is going to struggle, as we saw last night.
Yeah, and this game was also kind of indicative to me of why the Raptors' bench is so good, and I've been a big fan of theirs all season. I was a Pac-12 guy in college, so I really liked Jakob Poeltl and DeLon Wright, who played on some great Utah teams together, ending up in Toronto in the NBA. Van Vliet, another great college guy. Siakam, another really great college guy who didn't necessarily play that well in this game, but had two like pretty awesome missed dunks, like one of which he made.
Really good. Every time he gets the rebound, he just pushes the ball up the court very fluidly. So that really impressed me. Also,
he's just like a ball of energy. You know, you're right. He really does. Like he's one of those guys, and you normally associate this quality with point guards or point forwards like LeBron James, but He just kind of changes the pace of the game when he comes in, and that's a pretty incredible quality in a big man, and very unique, I think. I mean, not just in the modern NBA, but in the league, I think throughout the entirety of its history. So he's kind of a special player. And then Poeltl's a guy like who I wasn't really sure was going to have a ton of success in the NBA, even though I really liked him in college. Like, I just didn't really think he's a clean fit, but he's just flat out good. Like, he's figured out ways to be effective, even though he's not really a natural guy in the modern NBA. And same thing with DeLon Wright, who's not a great shooter, not the most explosive, but similar to Van Vliet, just really crafty and really knows how to play. So all that adds up to like a Raptors group that's one of my favorite in the league. And I know they've gotten like all the hype for like the revamped offense, and that's clearly a part of it. But I think that bench unit, and specifically like the energy that bench unit brings on both ends and how competitive and relentless they are on defense, I think to me that's what makes Toronto a different team this year than they have been in the past.
Yeah, and also just it's interesting to note how stacked that Utah Utes team was from a few years ago. I mean, I just realized it, but they had Poeltl, DeLon Wright, and Kuzma on the same team.
Yeah, that's why.
That's three pretty good NBA players.
No, they came into Tempe, Arizona. A young Gavin Shaw was broadcasting that game, and I was really excited for it. It was like the first time I was going to get to do a college game with like a top 10 team, and like they really filled up the crowd. Like Wells Fargo Arena, now known as the Bank, was rocking, and I think it was like 81-39 or something. Like, I've never watched an uglier college basketball game, and that team was just so good on both ends. So shout out to the Utes. Larry Kriskobiak, great coach. Sorry,
yeah,
go ahead.
And Andrew Bogut, former Ute.
Oh, yeah. But Oklahoma.
Going
yeah.
back to the Toronto's bench, I think they do a great job. All their pieces fit really well together. And they also have CJ Miles, who's kind of the gunner Nick Young type. He was horrible the first three quarters, and then I think he scored like 12 in a row for them in the fourth quarter. So he's a guy that just gets hot all of a sudden, complete microwave. So besides him, all their role players are extremely consistent. I mean, Poeltl, Siakam, DeLon Wright. I mean, they found this guy, Malcolm Mitchell. I've never even heard of him before. What's Malcolm Miller? Is that his name?
Yeah, you did. You literally texted our group chat, Marcus, what is Malcolm Miller?
Yeah, because I thought he was Mac Miller.
Right. Yeah, that's the issue. I think that'd be the greatest story in NBA history if, like, the Raptors just signed Mac Miller, like, post-trade deadline.
It's like when Hoodie Allen went from working at Google to dropping out and starting his rap career.
Yeah, pretty much the same thing.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's a great what if. He could have been a coworker with a friend of the pod, Leo Gladkov, but instead is a famous rapper.
Yeah, funny how these things work, Gavin. Funny how these things work.
Anywho, we're going to take a quick break and then come back with more talk on Nets Raptors. Attention cancer victims, if you or a loved one lived, worked, or visited Lower Manhattan in the months after the 9/11 attacks and have been diagnosed with cancer, federal benefits and health care may be available. Attorney Eddie Markowitz has helped many families recover substantial benefits from the September 11th Victims Compensation Fund. The James Zidroga Health and Compensation Act has been extended, but time is limited. Attorney Markowitz is proud to serve as counsel to the Zidroga family. Let him help you too. These benefits are not just for rescue workers, but to anyone who qualifies. The fund covers many cancers, including prostate, skin, lung, and breast. Please call 1-800-LAW-HELP. That's 1-800-LAW-HELP to see if you qualify. Okay, we'll get back into it. First, welcome back into the show. You're listening to Locked On Nets, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team 3 to 5 times a week. Gavin Shaw, Josh Bass with you talking Nets Raptors. And we're going to get back into it from a Nets perspective in a second. But first, I wanted to, and I guess this is kind of a Nets perspective, but I wanted to talk about the way Jonas Valanciunas dominated this one. 26 points, 14 rebounds, only 27 minutes. And I think it was pretty cool. Our boy Zach Lowe, Josh, actually got a shout out on the broadcast. There were Ryan Rucco and Sarah Kustak. Talking about the article that he wrote on the Toronto Raptors. And I think there was some quote from Valanciunas saying, like, this new offense made my life better. And he's another guy, in addition to, like, their bench, like, he's a big part of this Raptors redemption tale, like, a dude who, and maybe this will still be true in the playoffs, but would often kind of get played off the court because of his defense. And now he's almost, like, a dominant sixth man who gets to play with the starters and just comes in and wrecks havoc for 25 to 30 minutes a game. And the Nets in particular, without Jared Allen, really didn't have any sort of answer for him.
Yeah, I mean, they set him up really well, first of all. Van Fleet and Lowry did a good job of that. He was just catching the ball on the move every time, and he's just a massive 7-foot human being. And going up against Quincy Acey, Dante Cunningham, I mean, these guys are going to have no chance of stopping him. And even if he does miss the shot, Valanciunas is just going to get the offensive rebound. So there was just no chance that they were going to be able to stop him with that lineup they had out there. And obviously Jared Allen being out hurts, but kind of surprised, honestly, that Atkinson didn't go for either Mozgov or Jahlil Okafor, at least in spot minutes. I mean, if Okafor is not going to play in this game, I really don't even understand the point of having him on the team, because you might as well just cut him, because he's clearly not going to come back if they have no faith in him, even when you're playing 6'7" centers, to even just throw him out there.
Yeah, and no, I loved how just, like, aggressive Valanciunas was about pushing his advantage, because I think there are so many bigs in the league who are of similar size, but they're just not really confident enough in their post game or, like, jab pivot game to really attack smaller defenders one-on-one. And Valanciunas, like, knew he had an advantage, and it was like a high schooler going up against, like, 10-year-olds, and he's just punishing them play after play after play. As far as Okafor, I had the same thought during the game, and I was kind of wondering, like, why you wouldn't put him in, because you figure with his talent level and the way Valanciunas plays defense, like, I mean, Okafor isn't
stop, Gavin. That's ridiculous. Because
what? You didn't even let me finish my thought.
He's not a good player at all. But
well, offensively, he is.
I don't want to hear about him being good on offense this year, because he needs to prove it to me. I mean, he can do fancy footwork, but if the ball doesn't go in the hoop, what's the point of it?
I mean, I can look it up right now, but he's been objectively, like, good offensively this year. Like, not just, like, looking at, like, the eye test. Like, his stats offensively are good. I mean, I guess my point was, like, he wasn't going to cancel out Valanciunas, but. Yeah, I mean, yeah, shooting 54% from the field this year per 36, like 18 points a game. So, I mean, he's not, like, again.
I mean, his true shooting is league average, but people just make it out like he's the second coming of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Sure, that wasn't what I was saying. But my only point was, like, I mean, like, it was similar to what you were saying. Like, this is the type of game you put him in for. Like, he's not going to cancel out Valanciunas, but he's going to kind of do the same thing. And, like, he's going to cause some damage against him on the other end. And it's not like they were guarding Valanciunas anyway, so you might as well put him in there. So that's where my confusion stemmed from. And I guess it was probably because they didn't want the Raptors to start running pick and rolls and getting switches on Okafor, and then their guards start making threes, and then suddenly you have two problems instead of one. So maybe that was part of the issue, but yeah.
You have to try something different, I think. If he's getting absolutely roasted by Cunningham and or he's roasting Cunningham and AC, just try something different and see what happens. And worst case scenario, the Raptors guards hit a couple of threes, but I would at least give it a shot and see maybe if Okafor's size could be a deterrent.
Yeah, no, I'm not. I don't disagree with you. And then on the net side of things, like, obviously, like, we mentioned it, like, they stayed in it. Like, a lot of that was due to, I mean, D'Lo's obviously initial outburst, and then Rondé kind of paced them on offense from that point going forward. 7 of 11 from the field, 5 of 6 from the charity stripe, 19 points, 7 rebounds, got mediocre three-point shooting across the board outside of that. But I continue to be disappointed in how Spencer Dinwiddie's played in the second half of the season, and really ever since D'Angelo Russell has come back, he hasn't been the same guy. And there have been games where he's looked great and he's kind of discovered that magic he had for the first portion of this year, but all in all, extremely inefficient. This one, just 2 of 11 from the field, and he'll have, like, moments of brilliance. Like, I think the very first, or no, it was the second possession of the game, they had, like, a real, like, Spursgasm, like, possession where, like, all five guys touched the ball. D'Lo had an open three, but instead of shooting it, like, beat his guy off the ball, drew two more defenders, and got D'Lo for a wide open three, and you could argue that's what got D'Lo going for the next six. So it was, like, it's one of those little plays that show, like, beyond, like, the raw stats, what kind of positive impact Spencer Dinwiddie has on a team. But from a holistic perspective, and again, just looking at the shooting numbers, like, he's just been horrific. And tonight, or last night, rather, 2 of 11, 1 of 4 from 3, kind of continued that trend.
Yeah, no, it's tough to watch. I thought his playmaking was pretty decent, as you mentioned. Obviously, he's developed a really nice connection with Allen, who wasn't out there tonight. But, I mean, you can't just go 2 of 11 from the field. Really has to do a better job of maybe either being more of a pass-first point guard or kind of getting to the free throw line more, or just being more selective in picking his spots. And I do feel for the guy because he doesn't get a ton of spot-up opportunities, even though he's a really good spot-up three-point shooter. So when he is out on the court, he does have to create a lot. But it still seems like the fit between him and D'Lo, they're figuring some stuff out, which is to be expected.
Yeah. No,
also, LeVert was good this game, I thought. I thought his passing was really beneficial.
Yeah, I didn't even realize he had 7 assists. And also, like, defensively, he was really good. He finished with 3 steals, and yeah, I don't know. I think against good teams, like, he continues to be, like, he's, like, one of the few guys on the Nets that I think, like, time in and time out can, like, consistently score or even just, like, make stuff happen in isolation, because so many times when they play really athletic defenses, or in the Raptors' cases, like, just really long defenses that, like, know how to play and, like, are smart and, like, won't give up easy stuff, like, he's one of the guys, like, almost, like, regardless of situation, like, he can make a play, and I think that's indicative of how athletic he is, especially compared to the rest of this Nets team that frankly, like, is probably, if not the least athletic team in basketball, like, certainly one of. So I thought him and Hollis Jefferson, continuing a pattern, and Josh, like, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on this, because this is something I was talking about a lot while you were in Costa Rica, but I continue to really like him and Hollis Jefferson off the bench together, and I think this was, like, the fourth game in a row where they were two of the most important components of the Nets' effort.
Yeah, I know. I think it makes sense because those are two guys on the team that can create their own shot along with Spencer Dinwiddie and D'Angelo Russell, so I think it makes sense to have them balance kind of the lineup moving forward. And listen, I think that there's such a little difference between the starting lineup and the bench right now. I don't necessarily think there's a way that you really need to move all the most talented players to the starting lineup, because it really won't make much of a difference. But yeah, I think that LeVert and RHJ haven't been able to watch a ton since I was in Costa Rica. Unfortunately, we don't get Yes up there.
Yeah, really tough break for you.
Yeah, tough break for me. But from what I was seeing, that Karis really had some breakout games. And RHJ has been a consistent performer. I think he struggled a little bit when he first got back, but tonight he did a really good job. Just being active, hit a couple of tough jumpers, finishing inside. Good to see him get 6 free throw attempts. So it seems like he's rounding into form a bit, how he was prior to his injury.
Okay, we're going to wrap up the discussion of Nets-Raptors and come back with some thoughts on the Sixers, unless, Josh, you don't have any final thoughts on this game, do you?
No, I mean, I guess, do we think Whitehead's going to play it all the rest of the year? Because I actually like him. I thought he's been decent when he's played, but it just doesn't seem like he's ever going to get an opportunity.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess just like, and again, it's just like, it's the way like the roster construction is, like they're really guard heavy, and like the front court is where, like, if, again, like we've said this before, but like if Whitehead was like the same like talent of player and like a front court guy, like he'd be playing like 30 minutes a night, but that's just not the case. So I don't know. I think if no one gets hurt, like maybe like the last few games just as like a developmental thing, and maybe they'll shut down Russell or shut down Dinwiddie, and maybe he'll get some time. But I think outside of that, no, probably not.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And just one last note to touch on, that the Nets, three-point shooting-wise, they actually did really well. 42% on threes, excluding the D'Angelo Russell 7 of 7 at the start. I guess they were 8 for 29, which isn't particularly good. But the second half, the paint was just so crowded for RHJ and Karis, and no one could hit a shot when they kicked it out. So it was definitely frustrating to watch. Hopefully that they can get a little bit more shooting moving forward, and that maybe Jared Allen coming back will be able to ease things up more inside, and that could take some pressure off the three-point guys. So it's always tough to watch when you have wide open threes and you just can't hit them.
Yeah, it honestly, like, in the second half, it felt like watching, like, a college game with, like, the way, like, the Raptors were, like, defending them and, like, the lack of scoring. All right, anyways, 11 straight wins for the Toronto Raptors over the Brooklyn Nets. I think the Nets get them one more time this season, so maybe they'll have their shot at getting a win. Toronto, I think that was their 16th win in 17 games. A pretty ridiculous stretch for them.
In the North.
Yeah, we'll be back in a sec to talk Nets-Sixers and maybe touch on the Nets schedule the rest of this week.
Hey, guys, it's time to talk to you about the boatload of money you can make this week betting at MyBookie. If you haven't checked them out, this is the perfect time to get into the action. The madness of March is here. Lay down some money and score big on college hoops. You can join me and thousands of online players and start betting at mybookie.ag. Are you sick and tired of getting the runaround when you ask for a payout? Then come and join MyBookie today. I would only recommend a service that's been good to me and in turn our listeners. That's why I urge you to make your way to MyBookie. You win, they pay. Fast and without any hassles. You're wasting your time betting anywhere else. They have in-game live betting, so you can even place a bet after tip-off. Join now, and MyBookie will match your first deposit with a 50% bonus. You can even enter for a chance to win their $1 million bracket challenge. Use promo code LONBA to activate offer. Visit MyBookie today. Play, win, and get paid.
Welcome back in to the Locked On Nets podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. Gavin Shaw. A tan, Josh Bass with you, and we could have watched Nets Sixers this past Sunday, or we could have lied to you guys about having watched Nets Sixers this past Sunday, but we got a nice dinner instead, and sometimes you gotta do that. I did watch the first half, and to me that was enough given how the rest of the game went, and really my only significant takeaway was that. It was actually very similar to what Jonas Valanciunas did to the Nets against the Toronto Raptors, where they just didn't have any type of answer for Embiid, and he was just totally dominant in half number one. J.J. Redick, he finished with 12 points, but I think he had most of them in the first half and just kind of knocked the Nets out, and then Saric and Covington kind of took the Sixers home. I know the Nets won the first time they played, or at least the first time when they played in Barclays last time, but to me the Sixers just seemed like such a bad matchup for them between Embiid and like the size they have all over the court. And Philly, like, low key has been, like, especially in terms of like scoring margin, I think like one of the 10 best teams in the league since the All-Star break. So this one was kind of just unfair for the jump. And I was really hoping that the Nets momentum from the Hornets game would at least like carry them through part of the game. And then Philly's tendency to let down late would have gotten them the win, but that just totally didn't happen.
Yeah, well, Embiid's, I think he's only played four games against the Nets in his career, but he absolutely dominates them. Looking at his stats, last year he played two games against the Nets, averaged 27 points per game on 65% shooting from the field in only 26 minutes. I mean, even last year, Brook Lopez had no answer for him. The game that the Nets won at the start of the, or I guess a couple months ago, he was pretty quiet in the first half and then just completely torched Jared Allen in the second half. So when he gets going, he's completely unstoppable for this Nets team, and he's obviously going to be a problem. for the foreseeable future. There's really no way that he's going to be out of the division. What do you think of Saric, though? Because he has kind of unimpressed me every time I've seen him play, but he gets a lot of hype in NBA Twitter spheres, which we are a part of.
Yeah, he was so good in this game. I get what you're saying, Josh, and like, even though, like, in some ways, it's a really good team, I think Embiid's, like, the perfect player to have next to him because Saric can't really play center because he's not much of a rim protector, but Embiid, at the same time, can space the floor or post inside, and that's really what gives Philly, on top of having Ben Simmons at point guard, so much flexibility that both their bigs can legitimately play inside and out and make plays off the dribble and hold up on the defensive end. Like, that's just such a surreal combination, and it really does make Philly like fun to watch as a whole because they're such an abnormal team with some of the lineups they put out there. But Saric in this game, at least, and I'll like admit I haven't seen him like a ton over his career. I maybe watched 5 or 6 of his games, so I can't say I had an extremely strong opinion going in. But he was absolutely incredible in this one. 24 minutes, 18 points, 6 rebounds, 3 assists, 2 blocks, and just his overall versatility made it really hard for the Nets to guard. You saw him hitting from range, you saw him making plays off the dribble, you saw him posting up, and the combination of having a lot of energy and a lot of skill around the bucket was really too much for the Nets to match up with. So this one, I kind of got all the hype, and I saw what's around him, and I guess the reason you might be disappointed and people in general might be disappointed by him is because by the same token that Embiid's the ideal guy to play next to him, like he definitely takes away from his counting stats, and we've seen that in the past where when Embiid is out, Saric turns into one of the better young guys in the league, at least in terms of a volume scoring and rebounding perspective. So I think that's
he's
kind
still
of
averaging 15 and 7.
Just this season, you're saying?
This season, yeah.
Yeah, and I think last year, like when Embiid was out, he was more like 18 and 9 or something along those lines. So it's kind of a fascinating dichotomy. But all in all, to answer your question, I really like him.
Yeah, and looking at his stats now, I guess it's interesting because he doesn't really seem like a great three-point shooter. And whenever I watch him play, he misses a lot of threes. I guess it might be because he doesn't have a ton of gravity, because people don't really respect his three-point shot. But he's shooting 40% on 5 3-point attempts per game. I think it might be because Simmons isn't really the ideal fit next to him, because Saric is a playmaking forward as is. And he might be better served with a point guard that could shoot. So, like, if you swapped out Simmons with someone like of a comparable skill level at this point, like Mike Conley, more of a traditional point guard, I think he would really thrive. But I guess with Simmons out there, who doesn't shoot threes at all, it's kind of an awkward fit with him, Saric, and Embiid.
Yeah, it's so fascinating because they're kind of an anachronistic, using that word. Anachronistic.
Go for it, babe.
Yeah, anachronistic team. And a lot of it was Simmons at point guard, even though he's like the 6'10 freak. Like, but just the idea of, like, in the modern NBA of having a point guard that can't shoot is, if it was anyone other than Simmons, it would be such a limiting, almost crushing thing for a team. And I've gotten that watching the Knicks all year. And at times we've seen that with the Nets when Dinwiddie and D'Lo are kind of off their game. But those two bigs make it all work. And then you add in Covington and Redick, two guys who are lights out from three. Like, it's almost like they have, like, the best possible supporting cast for Simmons, and then Simmons is kind of an awkward fit for the rest of them. And to me, like, it makes them such an interesting team in the playoffs, because I think the consensus amongst most NBA people is that teams are going to make Simmons look bad in the postseason. That's what's been happening in a lot of fourth quarters, where the Sixers are disproportionately bad compared to how they play the rest of the games, and it's not even close. Like, I think I said this before they matched up, but for most of the year, they've been easily, like, the best first quarter team in the NBA, at least as far as scoring, and pretty easily the worst fourth quarter team in the league as far as scoring. And basically what people are saying is, like, in the playoffs, those issues are only going to get worse. But with all the talent they have and the way they've kind of come together in the second half of this year, like, I'm not necessarily sure that's true. And I think they could surprise some people.
Yeah, I mean, when you put so many talented players together in one situation, I think it's going to be people are going to underrate kind of the synergies that they create, and you have to talk about the talent on the floor. And I think that if Embiid gets his minutes really sticks in the playoffs, they could be super dangerous, especially because you're going to have a day off at least in between games, so he'll be pretty well rested. Don't have to worry about any backs to backs and things like that. So I actually wouldn't be surprised, as you mentioned, if they kind of make a decent run, at least win a series, and then take maybe an opponent to 7 games in the second round.
Yeah, it all kind of comes down to who they play. And I think, to me, the most interesting one is if they play the Cavs in the first round. Because I watched them the last time those two teams played. It just, you kind of got the idea that Philly matches up with them really well. And obviously, LeBron's going to get whatever he wants against that team. But Covington and Simmons are theoretically good guys to throw against him. And then having Embiid as a rim protector is at least a little bit of a deterrent for LeBron. So I don't know. And like, and this Cavs team is more vulnerable than they've been at any point in the last few years. So to me, that would really be fascinating.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I can't count LeBron out in any series, but it would certainly be a tough matchup.
Yeah, it feels like one of those things where, like, Cleveland might sweep them, but every single game would be really close.
Right. Like how it was when they played Detroit a few years ago and Stanley Johnson guaranteed victory.
Yeah, that was great. All right, I think that's a good note to end on. The Nets play the Sixers Friday and the Mavericks Saturday. So we'll get you at least one more podcast before the end of the week. I will not be on that one because I am broadcasting the New York City High School state championship game this weekend. So if you want to actually, first two are from Barclays Center. So if you want to support your boy, you can tune in on the NFHS network. If you don't, I understand. But at least to listen to the podcast, I think Josh is going to be recording with friend of the show, Marcus Barahal, pending Marcus's interest in doing that. But
he is interested.
Okay, all right, that's a good sign.
So frenemy of the show, Marcus, gone with me.
Yeah,
for seeing any changes.
Yeah, that's a fair deal. Okay, so you guys will get that, and you'll get a version of the Lost Marcus and Josh podcast we did earlier this year. Until then, be well. Keep enjoying this Nets season, and we'll be back Friday or Saturday.